Just for a moment, actually, because some members still are in caucus, so I'm looking to just recess until about 4 o'clock. So hopefully we'll all be back by 4. With that, we're at recess. To the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and appreciate the courtesies of those had to wait for us to conclude some other meetings. So the way we're going to look at this today, colleagues, is first have a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3666, and then follow it up with a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2912. So with that, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3666. And let's see, to introduce the bill. Are you here to introduce the bill, Mr. Kapoori? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kapoori. I'm here today representing the law firm of Stoll, Stoll, Bernie, Lotkin, and Schlachter. I'm also here representing a coalition of people on House Bill 3666. The Senate Bill 609 was passed by this body, by the Senate, and signed into law by the governor on the 5th of August. After it was passed, some members of the defense bar thought that there were some problems in that bill, which perhaps some unintended consequences, which would be unfair to some of their clients. And so they talked to our firm and some other firms. There were a group of people, securities defense firms, corporate counsels that represent security issuers, broker dealers, auditors and accountants, all the people in the securities fraud business, securities business, and people are concerned about securities fraud. Excuse me. I hope none of those are involved in the business of fraud. And it was after a group of meetings facilitated by the Oregon State Bar, we came to an agreement, and that agreement, which you have in front of you, is House Bill 3666. We can go into as much or as little detail, Mr. Chair, as you would like on the provisions of this bill. I'd like to ask Mr. Stoll and Mr. Shore from their firm, and Mr. Arinello of Kennedy Watts, Arinello and Ricks, and Mr. Murrow, Andrew Murrow of Foster Pepper. Those folks are all here and would like to briefly explain what's in the bill. As I say, you can get the amount of detail that you wish.
All right. Any questions, Mr. Kapoori? Mr. Kapoori, have you seen the August 14 letter from Gary Grenley
that was provided to me?
And just seeing this right now, I mean, I'm
sorry, that's a different letter. There have been at least one other letter. Yes, I haven't seen that particular one.
All right. See about giving you a copy of that and have you come back and respond to it. It sounds like, I mean, it's hard just looking at it. I mean, he's bringing up issues of concern about this bill, and I would appreciate some feedback on it.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that. Let me just comment that we understand that there are some members of the plaintiff's bar who are unhappy with this bill. The compromise, I think, goes too far in the direction which they would not like to see. However, the compromise that we have, we think, is a consensus of a wide range of folks. And we're interested in looking at those. We'd be happy to talk about them, other people's comments, but frankly, we're not supportive of them.
All right. Maybe see if we can actually respond to the specifics of the letter before we get a blanket opposition. And did you want your clients forward to speak about something? Okay.
I'm Robert Stoll, and Scott Shore from our firm.
Chair and committee members, my name is Joe Arellano, Portland law firm of Kennedy, Warren, Arellano, and Ricks.
here largely to respond to any questions. I'd be happy to summarize what's in the joint written testimony that we've submitted, if you'd like.
If you would, please.
Sure.
Explain the bill a little.
There are, thank you, Chairperson Doyle. Again, my name is Scott Shore from the law firm of Stoll, Byrne, Locke, and Schlachter. I'll just briefly summarize. There are four, essentially, bullet points in the joint testimony. This bill does approximately four or five things, which I'll go through. First, the bill amends ORS 59.1151 and ORS 59.1271. Those are sections of the Oregon Securities Law, and those are also sections 1 and 2 of the enrolled Senate Bill 609 that was previously passed. And the only change there is that we'll replace the term offers with the term successfully solicits, and it's going to codify some an understanding of the term that was expressed in Pinter versus Dahl, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and a more recent Multnomah County Circuit Court case called American Industries versus Imaging Technologies Corp. The second thing this bill will do will delete ORS 59.1151C and ORS 59.1271C. Those are some liability provisions, and we'll essentially move those liability provisions under sections ORS 59.1151B and ORS 59.1271B. The third thing this bill will do, it will amend Section 4 of Senate Bill 609. The amendment will replace the term participates or materially aids with the term aiders and abettors. It also gives a due diligence defense and a right of contribution to those who are considered secondarily liable. Those are secondary participants in a fraud committed by a primary violator. In addition, the amendment to Section 4 would make clear that the plaintiff can only recover those damages that have actually been caused by the fraudulent conduct that's in violation of Section 4. So it serves a causation element with respect to loss causation. The damages must be caused by the violation. Finally, there was a problem with Senate Bill 609 in that it had retroactive application to criminal conduct. I know as one of the proponents of Senate Bill 609, and talk of the other opponents, no one intended or even realized that the retrospective application could apply to criminal conduct, and that would raise constitutional issues. So this bill cleans that up and makes clear that criminal conduct can only be punished prospectively under the Senate bill. Excuse me, under this House bill.
Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Is that Section 4 of this bill? What you just referred to, or is that something else?
I'm sorry. When I've been saying Section 4, I'm referring to Section 4 of enrolled Senate Bill 609, which is the bill that was passed. The changes, Section 4 of Senate Bill 609 is really Section 3, I believe, of this House Bill 3666.
Right. If I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
The last thing you said was about the retroactivity issue.
Correct.
And I'm asking in a backhanded way, I guess, what is Section 7, Chapter 631, Oregon Laws 2003, which is repealed by Section 4 of this bill? I probably should have been more explicit.
I believe that's the retroactivity provision. And essentially what's happening is we're replacing the retroactivity provision of this bill with the retroactivity provision of the prior bill. The prior bill, Senate Bill 609, had retroactivity for both civil and criminal conduct. This bill, House Bill 3666, is retroactive still with respect to civil liability, but for criminal conduct it's prospective only.
Other questions? Representative Moss Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have a question. I think it puts those of us who haven't been on judiciary in sort of an awkward position to try to really fully understand the ramifications of this. So I have, I talked with the representative from Lake Oswego who helped me understand this a little bit better than what I did before I talked with him. And he did say that this was a compromise of wide variety and feels, and since he was, I think, the sponsor of the previous bill, or at least very much involved with the carrier, that at least what was proposed and this bill really does make some good fixes.
Representative Barnhart?
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to get around this. I'm very interested in making sure that we have an efficient capital market in Oregon. I think it's important that we put capital and people who want to manage capital together in ways that are beneficial for Oregon, and I'm assuming that's what this bill is about, is we're trying to get that working successfully. I wonder if you could explain a bit more about the issue that you're trying to deal with when you remove offers or and replace it with successfully solicit the sale of, and the second piece that I'm wondering about is this issue of participates or materially aids as compared to abets. Can you explain a bit what it is that we're trying to get at in these changes, recognizing that those of us on this committee understand these are technical words and don't know what the technical words mean?
If I may, Representative Barnhart, again, my name is Joe Arellano. I'm in private practice, but I began my legal career with the Securities and Exchange Commission in New York. With respect to the question of the difference between offers and successfully solicits those terms, the purpose of that change is simply to narrow the universe of potential non-sellers who could be potentially liable under the securities law. And the reason for the change is to prevent mere offers that don't result in a sale from being actionable. If someone makes an offer, makes a communication, which is later corrected under the Senate Bill 609 that came into law last week, that could be actionable. And by that, you're chilling capital formation, you're chilling communication by small businesses and startup companies, and no one here wants that to see that happen. I don't believe that was the intent of the original bill. So that's kind of more of a fine-tuning, I believe, that occurred through this consensus bill. With regard to the difference between participant and aider and abettor, again, we're trying to avoid snaring the innocent person into a net of liability where a person had no knowledge of a fraud wrongdoing. And that's the purpose for making that change, because participant has been interpreted very broadly by the Oregon courts. And we want to make clear that we're simply because someone touched a part of a transaction in which a third person committed a fraud does not make that person vicariously liable. So we're trying to avoid vicarious liability for people who did nothing wrong. And that is, I think, in my mind, the primary reason for that alteration.
Questions? Representative Berger?
Thank you. That's a very good answer. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me see if I can kind of better understand the process here that's taken place. You were the proponents of Senate Bill 609?
We were the private proponents for this bill. There were some public proponents, including the state treasurer and the attorney general's office.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, follow up.
Senate Bill 609 went through the complete process and was signed by the governor, who is an attorney and former Supreme Court judge. At some point, something happened that made you start amending 609. Someone found mistakes in it. I'm a little foggy right in there as to what happened to 609 that we now have this bill.
Representative Verghier, I think the answer to that is that and what you will see here today in the written testimony, no one is debating the original purpose for Senate Bill 609, which the primary purpose of which was to address the situation with PERS funds and other state funds being able to sue Enron-type situations, Enron-type market fraud. What we're doing here is we've noticed some unintended consequences, in our view, of the statute and effects that I don't believe had anything to do with that type of statutory change, and I'm not sure were contemplated at the time. A broader range of lawyers involved in representing businesses, representing professionals who are often sued in these cases, noticed these problems in the last couple of weeks, and we've been trying very hard to bring other people into the forum to get the attention that this compromise bill resulted in. So I would say that, that we are not, and this House Bill 3666 does not intend to alter the original purpose of the legislation, but simply is addressing some unintended consequences, in my view.
Okay. I understand it. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Can you tell me, and I feel the same way, I'm not looking to go back and redo 609, as I am trying to look to just correct, you know, whatever deficiencies have been found since then. Was it the original 609 that removed participant liability, or is that now what's happening with 3666?
Actually, neither. Participant liability still exists under Oregon law in a provision that deals with civil liability for what I'll refer to as innocent misrepresentations. One part of the bill before this committee deals with the anti-fraud provision of the Oregon Security Statute, which is in a different place. And it is in that specific section that deals with anti-fraud as opposed to simple misstatements that don't have that level of culpability that a different standard is being employed, an aider and abettor standard. But participant liability still exists. It exists before last week. It existed last week. It'll exist tomorrow because that's not being tinkered with as part of this legislation.
All right. And then another issue that came up was whether this will require, or this actually causes a change in strict liability for sellers. Elimination of absolute seller liability for violations of ORS 59.135.
I don't believe that is accomplished by this compromised legislation. If anything, it's been broadened to include not only sellers, which the prior law did, but the people who actively or successfully solicit the sale, if we're talking about the amendments to Section 115 and 127. In that respect, there is a broader range of potential people who are liable. So in my view, it certainly broadens the remedies and the types of claims that can be brought, but within reason.
All right. It's also been suggested that this amendment will add a limitation on recovery for violations of 59.135 that's not present anywhere else in the Oregon Securities Act, loss causation. And I guess the question brought up was, what does the phrase caused by the violation mean?
Sure, I'd be happy to address that, Chair Doyle. And this relates to your question about participant liability. Like participant liability, rescissionary damages are still available under the Oregon securities law, and that's in Section 59.115 and 127. The only thing that this bill changes is that it requires in a fraud on the market, and that's what the language we've been tinkering with 59.135. A fraud on the market where you've got an impersonal transaction, not a direct buyer and seller, but simply someone buying in the open market and claiming fraud. Most courts around in the nation, the federal courts, have viewed that there has to be some causal connection between what you claim is the fraud and what your damages are. And that's a bedrock principle of our civil law and has been for as long as I can remember.
Other questions, this panel? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Andrew Morrow.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon, with the firm of Foster, Pepper and Tews, LLP. I just wanted to urge the committee to pass this bill. Basically, as was mentioned, this bill got through the process. Our usual mechanisms in which in the bar we keep track of these legislation didn't communicate it as widely as we'd like to. We had some poor communications, and to the extent there were concerns about the bill, they weren't communicated properly. That's why we're here. We're trying to get a good result, and this is part of the compromise. I've at least had a chance while I was sitting here of reading Mr. Grenley's letter. It sounds like maybe you've got your questions answered, but I'd be happy to respond to those things.
Did you identify any other issues that he had in his letter than what I brought up?
Well, I think the one point maybe is that ORS 59135, which is the source of the fraud on the market liability, has there has been court decisions that have questioned whether there is any civil right of action for that legislation in the past. This bill clearly makes civil liability for that, so that is Senate Bill 609. And this bill is responding to some more precision with respect to that. I think his last point with respect to the retroactive date is, in fact, Senate Bill 609 hasn't gone into law yet. It won't go into law until January 1st. Because we're here and doing this now, the law, by the time it goes into effect, will be the combination of the two bills.
All right. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Dave Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and I guess you could describe us as the prospective abettors in the bill. I have three issues I just want to raise with the committee. I believe that we support the bill, and it is a clarification of a bill that's already gone through the process. First question, and on page one, on line nine, in the term security, we want to make sure that it's just understood that since it's not defined in the bill, that the term security does not include annuities or other insurance products. We don't believe that it does. That's in the securities law.
Right. And at least for the record and as part of legislative intent, my understanding is that it does not include that.
Second point on the major section, I think, of the bill is Section 3 and amendments, which are Section 4, I think, of 609 on page 4 on line 12. In the creation of the affirmative defense for the seller of the security, the broker or the dealer, I'm not exactly sure, and in discussions with the attorneys who represent and who crafted the compromise, there's not a clear answer to it, but does this create a responsibility on the part of the securities dealer, the agent, to do supplemental research beyond that that's given to him by his brokerage house or the major player in the distribution of the security to get to that point where he has an affirmative defense? And the answer that I've been given is that that's an area of gray that will probably be defined by the courts that we really don't know, and there may not be an accurate answer to that. The point of that is that it leaves my clients out there in a relatively loose area of not knowing when they should go forward and try to do supplemental research to see if what they're being told from above is, in fact, what's actually occurring in the issue. And the third issue, Mr. Chair, would be on line 18 and the bolding of joint and several liability introduction into that area. I'm told also that that's a restatement of already existing joint and several liability and not creation of a new responsibility on the part or for the individual independent securities dealer.
And that's my understanding as well. To your second point and the concern you have, is there, I guess, any suggestion on your part as alternative language that would assist your clients?
Mr. Chair, I don't have suggested alternative language. I think, as has been described to me by some of the lawyers behind me, that there just is not a real clear answer to that. Yep. You can think of, I guess, you either... You're absolutely, if you follow the research that's presented to you by your brokerage company and do not deviate from that by introducing supplemental statements regarding the viability of a particular security, then that could be a defense that you were, but that's so, yeah. Prospective analysis of that differs frequently from retrospective analysis of that as to what you should or should not have done in a particular instance.
Okay. Any further questions? All right. All right. Thank you for testimony. Tim Craven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, nation's largest high-tech trade association. We got involved in this due to concerns expressed by some of our firms and some of the lawyers and people who help do structuring, particularly of startup firms, about some of the possible issues that would be involved, particularly in that word offers, some of that early stage conversation that goes on in capital formation. And as it was expressed to me by one of the top lawyers in Portland who has helped found many of our member companies, part of the concern is the level of due diligence that he would have to do with an embryonic company to ensure that, quite frankly, his backside was covered, could exceed the ability of that startup company to afford. In other words, he would have a hard time talking to people based upon the amount of diligence that he might have to assume given the enhanced liability of this change, which could impede in a very significant way his ability to work with new companies and help startups get on their feet. So that was expressed to me. That's part of our interest in the bill and our interest in helping work and grow new companies in Oregon and such. So I really want to say just today thank the committee for introducing this bill 48 hours ago and having this hearing today, and all the people behind me, particularly the members of the Oregon State Bar, who've kind of helped do shuttle diplomacy in getting this together to you today. And I can't say I won't represent them, but we are in close contact with the governor's office and the treasurer's office to avoid any potential road bumps on this. And I think people understand this is something that we need to fix, and we really do appreciate your taking the time to help us do so before the end of session. Thank you.
Any questions? All right, thank you. No one further needed or scheduled to testify on this? Representative Barhart?
Were we going to hear from Mr. Grenley?
I was on the list. I'm Mr. Essler. Mr. Grenley couldn't be here this afternoon.
Nope, come on forward.
I handed out a letter which covers the remarks that I was going to make. My name is Michael Essler. I'm an attorney practicing in the securities end of the business. I do litigation, and I've been practicing as such for 30 years in Oregon. And I'm here to oppose the bill. I've spoken with many of the other members of this part of the bar, the plaintiff securities lawyers, about various aspects of this proposed fix. And we have some concerns over the choice of language and some of the concepts that are involved. And I'll first of all approach the language issues that we have. The word successfully solicit, which is found in the first part of the amendment. That word is a term of art. It's used by securities brokerage firms and by the SEC and NASD to define whether a broker called the customer and recommended that he buy XYZ Corp, or the customer called the broker and said, I want to buy XYZ Corp. And we're concerned that the use of that word in this particular statute will, because it deals with the securities field, take on the definition that's already in place in the industry, which would mean that a broker who told Mr. Smith, buy XYZ Corp, Mr. Smith then goes and golfs with his three partners and says, I just bought XYZ Corp, it's a great deal, call my broker, would be the only one of the foursome that could bring a claim. Because the other three people, having initiated the call to the broker, would have made unsolicited purchases. And we don't think it's the purpose of the Act, 609 in the first place, or even of the amendment to the Act, to exclude the other three gentlemen that were in the foursome from being able to sue if, in fact, the broker had misrepresented facts or was involved in a scheme to defraud investors. That all four of those investors, even though three initiated the call, all four should have the same rights. And so I'm concerned this has been thrown together, the amendment has been thrown together quickly, and we think that the language should be examined more carefully. That was the thrust of one of Mr. Grenley's responses as well. The second concern, moving forward in gravity, is the interjection of aider and abettor liability as opposed to participant liability. Oregon has long led the way in trying to make the securities market safe and efficient. Representative Barnhart asked that question, I think, earlier. And one of the ways in which the securities market operates efficiently is when people can trust the representations that are made to them by the people trying to raise capital. And with all due respect to the need for startup companies to raise capital, even more importantly from startup companies, the investor needs to have full and fair disclosure. And the way that that's accomplished under the Oregon Act and in the Oregon securities market is that lawyers and accountants are generally involved in raising significant amounts of capital. Those lawyers and accountants act for the seller, but they act as a gatekeeper. And so what the securities laws in Oregon do is extend to those participants who are paid for their services the same kind of liability that they would have to the investor as if each individual investor hired them. It's not an unfair standard. They're hired by the seller. They only work once. There's only one set of lawyers and one set of accountants. They work on the transactions, but their cost is spread out over every investor, thereby giving us a cheap, efficient market system. If those lawyers or those accountants or other professionals involved don't do a good job in doing due diligence, then they will be liable if there were misrepresentations or fraud in connection with the sale. That's not an unfair system. Eliminating the word participant and inserting the word aider and abettor in its place is not acting in an equivalent fashion with the other aspects of the Oregon securities laws. The difference is that some courts have held, and I don't know that I would agree with this, but some courts have held that as far as aider and abettor liability is concerned, there is a degree of scienter or knowledge of the fraud or wrongdoing that's required before a person becomes an aider and abettor. A participant, on the other hand, is a person who meaningfully contributes to the sale. That's what the Oregon courts have said. It's not a dragnet. The person has to meaningfully participate in the sale. If it's an aftermarket context, the same rule would apply. The courts have yet to define what a participant would be in an aftermarket context under the Oregon Act because it hasn't been in place yet. But the courts will define it, and what they've done is they've defined participant to be something more than simply a scrivener, something more than simply a person who does a ministerial act, but somebody who provides ingenuity and important participation in the sale. And the Oregon courts have been careful about that, and I think they would be equally careful in the aftermarket situation. But eliminating participant liability is going to take us back a step to a point where you would have to show, perhaps, some actual knowledge, some degree of knowledge greater than a participant. Now, a participant who can show he did not have actual knowledge, and if he exercised reasonable care, would not have learned of the facts upon which the liability is based, has that affirmative defense and walks free. So, including the language participant and not taking it out of the statute doesn't unfairly treat people who participate in a transaction because they still have available the affirmative defense of lack of knowledge and inability to get the knowledge even if they exercise reasonable care. Taking it back one step, that's the malpractice standard. The third concern I have...
Mr. Esler, hold you just a minute. On that issue, is that something that was changing current law, or is that a change just in Senate Bill 609?
It's simply in 609.
What's the standard?
Under 115 and 127, it's participant liability. Participants are liable. That's the uniform standard under the Oregon Securities Act. This would become a new standard for 135, which would be more limited than our general standard for securities liability. And we see no reason why a new, less a more restrictive standard should be adopted, particularly not today when we're trying to encourage confidence in the market and where much of the result of the fall of the market has been caused not by the change in the economics of the businesses, but the confidence of the consumer, the confidence of the investor. That's what's caused our collapse.
Can you tell me who benefits from this change, in your opinion?
The investing public and then the public in general. And the reason is because... by the change.
We implement the change as drafted.
It would be professionals who were involved in transactions that involve aftermarket security sales and also initial offerings as well. And those are the people that would most benefit. And those are the people that are paid to take the risk and can afford to do it and pass the cost on, ultimately to the investor, but, you know, broken down by thousands of investors as opposed to having each investor incur the cost themselves.
So then not making this change or not adopting this change and going instead with what current law is, then it's your argument at least that it's the consumer that benefits more,
yes,
as opposed to the professionals.
Not only the consumer, but also the market as a whole, which means that we all benefit, even if we're not an investor in that particular transaction. The next issue I want
to follow up on,
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think you're referring to Section 3, which amends Section 4 of Chapter 631, which is on page 4, lines 8 through 14. I think that's the part you're referring to in what we're just discussing.
Yes.
The question I have is, in the bill, the affirmative defense that you referred to is added language. Does that affirmative defense exist in Chapter 631 in some other form?
It existed in the original act, and as I understand the way this would work, this section would then fit into 59.115, mm-hmm, become a new subsection, and the participant would have had the defense that was available already in 59.115 sub 3 and 59.127 sub 3. So it doesn't, that part of the change doesn't change the way in which the act would work.
Okay, could I follow up on that?
Sure.
I'm sticking with this language. So your problem isn't with lines 12 through 14.
No.
Your problem is with the change from participants or materially aids to aids and abets.
Yes.
Okay. Now, say a couple more words, if you could, about this word and this word abets, mm-hmm, as it relates to the issues we're talking about here. I think I understand what you're saying, but I'm not certain.
The court in Prince versus Bryden, Judge Lindy, discussed the fact that there is a difference between a participant and an aider and abettor. Unfortunately, he didn't give us any guidance as to what aider and abettor actually meant. He worked on the word participant from that point forward in his decision. But the restatement of the law, second, restatement of torts, defines aider and abettor. And most recently, I think in Greenwich versus Harding, the Oregon Court of Appeals considered the word, the phrase aider and abettor. And what it involves is a person who helps someone else commit a tort. And so the restatement says there's one of three elements that must be necessary. One of those elements is knowledge or scienter. Another is achieving a common goal where you commit a tort and the third person commits or a second person commits a tort and the two of you work together. But in each case it involves something other than simply doing a meaningful contribution. There has to be more. And we believe that the way in which the Oregon securities laws have operated and operated effectively is to put the burden on a person if he meaningfully participates in the sale of a security, the burden then becomes on him to show that he did not know that there was anything wrong with what was happening and could not have learned of it in the exercise of reasonable care. And what we're speaking goes mainly to professionals who are involved in the transactions. And today it's very hard to sell securities unless you have an accountant and a lawyer willing to sign off on the offering. And so that's a way in which the statute works without much interjection by the state. We don't have to have the state supervising offerings of securities. Instead, we have professionals who sign off saying we've done the due diligence that's necessary to say that this is okay.
Mr.
Escher, were you involved at all in 609?
No.
Were you involved in the work done on the compromise?
No. I became aware of the compromise yesterday.
All right. And so through the process, you also were not an opponent of 609?
No, I would not have proposed 609 at all.
All right. Thank you very much.
In fact, you know, I think it's important for the citizens of Oregon that we have an efficient market, and you can only have that if you have full disclosure, and you either have the government trying to mandate full disclosure and look over the shoulder of the offerors, or you have the framework which we have in Oregon, which is the plaintiff's bar acts as a private attorney general for the state and enforces fair disclosure when companies fail. The other thing I wanted to discuss was the issue of loss causation, which is interjected into this clause.
In the same paragraph, isn't it?
Yes, in the same paragraph, Section 3. And there, you know, I know Mr. Arellano spoke about the issue of showing how you've been harmed. The problem with injecting the notion of loss causation has been that many courts have used this to basically gut the Securities Act. In other words, supposing you're encouraged to invest in a security because you're told that it's going to do a new public offering or it's going to have a public announcement next month. That's the reason why you invest. Well, the company doesn't make the public announcement that was promised. And in fact, because its books were cooked, the company fails. The argument is raised when you have language like caused by the violation, that the violation was the promise that there'd be a public announcement. Well, that hasn't caused the company to go bankrupt, hasn't caused anything to occur when it doesn't happen. The benefits and detriments of your investment, the underlying company, is still the same. And so you have been caused no damage by the violation. That's the argument that's raised and has been successful in some courts. And the concern I have is that injecting that language into the Oregon Securities Act for the first time basically guts the notion of our Securities Act, which is premised on the notion that selling securities is like fishing or hunting. You get a license to sell securities, just like you get a fishing or a hunting license, because you cross T's and dot I's. If you don't, then the game you shot or the fish you caught or the money you collected has to be paid back. That's the way our Securities Act works. That's why absolute liability for a seller of securities is a fair thing to do. Just like a hunter who fails to buy a deer tag during deer season, when he shoots a deer, he's shot a deer during a legal season, he didn't pay $15, he's got to pay the fine. The fine in the case of a hunter is set by statute. In the case of the securities laws, the fine is you have to give the money back if you didn't do it right. And that's a licensing mechanism, and that's what the Oregon Securities Act adopted way back when it was first enacted. And for a long time it was carried in the section of law under licenses. But that basic framework works, because what it does is it places the penalty on the people involved in issuing a security. They become a guarantor. And so you better believe they're careful. You better believe that when a startup company comes into my office or any other lawyer's offices today, that we say to them, you better have a good product and you better be able to prove it to me before I'm going to represent you with public investors. And is that a bad thing? No. It means that if a company goes out with my name on its offering circular, I've taken the pains to make sure, not just for me, but for every investor out there, that full disclosure, full and fair disclosure has been made. And that's the way our system works.
Questions? Harrison Barnhart?
I think this is my last one. You'd be happy with this section we've been discussing if participates and materially were left alone, and if sustained was left alone. The rest of it is okay with you, if I understand your position correctly.
I don't like the caused by the violation.
I'm sorry, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Removing caused by violation
and
left the word sustained.
Yes. The act as it was originally
But the language in 12 through 14 is okay.
Yes.
Because that simply restates the general rule that already exists.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. I understand that.
All right. Further questions? Okay. Thank you for testimony. Well, colleagues, obviously this is something that we've just had this thrown at us, and you know, I'm very comfortable. If you want to at least get some responses to this, we can do that, and then maybe see where we go from there. But if there's a need for further work on this, I'm still fine doing that if that's what the direction we want to go.
You mean taking some more time?
Yeah, if you know, after we get some response from the proponents, to the issues that were raised, and then we can make some decisions on that.
I'd like to hear from them.
All right, come on forward.
I'm Robert Stoll, and my office were the principal private proponents of SB 609. We represent OPERS in securities fraud litigation, and this revised bill is a compromise bill. There's things in here that we may not have been as happy with as possible, but at the same time, there were things that some of the defense bar wanted that they didn't get in this, and rightly or wrongly, we made a deal with them, and we stand by it. That. I do think that some of the concerns.
Hold just a moment, Representative.
Just to follow up on that line. So your opinion is that even if you and Mr. Esler got together, you still could not come to agreement on the issues that he has just presented to us. These issues that you had already discussed in your compromise group, right?
Yes. The answer is that I'm sure Mr. Esler and I could probably agree. Mm-hmm. I think the issue is that between what we thought we wanted to accomplish with 609, what we thought the political realities were perhaps of some of the proponents of making any changes to 609, that this was a reasonable compromise. And so I don't think that some of the concerns of Mr. Esler are as serious a problem as he, or a problem for that matter, as he indicates. Some of the issues are unknown. The aider and abettor issue is unknown. I mean, I don't know that is necessarily, we use the word participant. That is consistent with the, as Mr. Esler pointed out, with the original, the other sections of the securities laws. Maybe I should explain something, an overview of what 609 was intended to accomplish. The Oregon securities laws have been interpreted by a couple of courts, not all courts, to apply to sales of securities when there is a direct sale by a seller, an issuer, for instance, to a an investor. But some courts have interpreted that a so-called fraud in the market case, and I'll explain what that is in just a second, that the Oregon statute, as it heretofore has pre SB 609, there was no fraud in the market cause of action. A fraud in the market case is a situation which you had in WorldCom or Enron. In other words, the issuer puts out a false financial statement, but the investor, Opers or somebody else, does not buy from WorldCom or Enron. They buy on the New York Stock Exchange or somewhere else. And they have no direct deal with the issuer. But what happens is because the books were cooked, the price of that stock is inflated, and everybody that buys in that market, whether they bought from Enron or bought from WorldCom, suffers. And after the fraud is disclosed, the market price plummets and the person is injured. That's basically a fraud on the market case. So the idea, a principal reason, not the sole reason, but a principal reason for SB 609 was to cover that situation. And we think that we did do that. There is still, the word participant still exists with respect to the direct sales in the existing law. There's no difference on that. The words, there is an ambiguity as to what is meant by aiders and abettors. I'm not convinced that it's any more than participants. I'm sure some defense lawyer might argue that, but I'm not sure that that's the case. I think the idea of the loss causation issue is one that is in the federal securities laws when they are used under in fraud in the market cases. That's consistent with that, as opposed to a rescissionary measure of damages. In other words, a rescissionary measure of damages being that I bought the security from you, I was operating different facts, I get my money back. That, I think, is certainly an appropriate damage test when the person is buying directly from the fraudulator, so to speak. I'm not sure, frankly, that the words, the language here of changing sustained to caused by the violation is, I don't know that there's any difference. But my brethren here, Mr. Arellano, like that language better. And since we were able to make a deal, I went along with it. So I didn't think I was giving up anything. And that was fine. I'm ambivalent on that language.
All right. Mr. Arellano?
Yes, if I could follow up, Chair Doyle. I think an important point to keep in mind is that we are not talking about restricting or cutting back the Oregon securities law in any respect. All the remedies that existed before last week under the Oregon securities law will exist today, tomorrow, and in the future. What we're trying to do here is to modify and clarify what was Senate Bill 609 and the exceedingly broad scope, I think unintendedly broad scope, that it provided. So we are simply, I think, cutting back on what 609 did. We are not here to suggest that the Oregon securities law, as they existed a week ago, should be cut back to deprive people who have rights of action. We are not doing that. This compromise bill does not do that. I believe that there will be more remedies because we are creating new private rights of action under 135 that didn't exist before. So in that respect, the Oregon Securities Law are going to be stronger. There's going to be more remedies than there were before. We're simply cutting back from the scope that 609, I believe, unintendedly provided. And that's, in my view, all we're doing. And I'll follow up on what Mr. Stoll just mentioned, that in the comments you've received against this, nowhere do they talk about the intended purpose for which this bill was offered, and that was the PERS state agency Enron situation. That's not being discussed at all, because what we're talking about are just the issues along the margins that were the unintended consequences, which now, because others might find it in their interest to have a broader law and make professionals, accountants, lawyers, guarantors for their clients. I don't believe that's ever been the state of Oregon law, and I don't think it should be. That would be a real chill on capital formation and business in this state, and I don't think we want to do that.
I'd like to add one thing I meant to say, and that is that I do not believe in any way that the word aider and abettor means that the plaintiff has to prove knowledge of the aider and abettor. In fact, the law is, this is the language that is very specific in here. This is the language at the end of that section 4 of chapter 631, that it says that unless the person who aids and abets the violation sustains the burden of proof that the person did not know and in the exercise of reasonable care could not have known of the existence of the facts on which the liability is based. In other words, the burden of proof is on that defendant to prove that they acted reasonably. And it is not limited to just misrepresentations or just limited to omissions of fact. It is also any artifice and so on. And so, this is a broadening of the, as Mr. Arellano indicates, this section of 609 is a new law. There's a reasonable, this is not strict liability here, but the burden of proof is on the defendant. It's not on the plaintiff to prove that they knew that the aider and abettor had any particular knowledge.
Okay. Mr. Morrow, did you have anything further?
I don't think I have anything to add there.
All right. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hadn't missed the point that if we adopt Mr. Esler's interpretation of aider and abettor, then the language at the end of the section there that you referred to is unnecessary.
But there would be no reason for that.
For that language, if aider and abettor meant that you knew about it.
Right.
If that's the normal interpretation, if that's what that legal language normally means, then it's confusing in this bill, isn't it? If the term aider and abettor normally means that somebody who knew about the fraud, whatever the problem is, then including it in the statute this way makes the statute kind of confusing, doesn't it?
Well, it makes it's nonsensical. There would be no reason why you would have the burden of proof. Shift to the defendant if the plaintiff in the first instance had to prove knowledge. If he had to prove knowledge, obviously the defendant wouldn't be able to prove he didn't know. So
right.
that doesn't make any sense. I mean, that, how would that work? So that's, you're completely correct, Representative Barnhart.
I had another question, if I could. One of you said, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was, that we're simply talking about one section of the securities law and we're kind of adding in a piece that has to do with fraud on the market. Now, does that describe what the sections of the bill we're talking about modifying actually does, or are we talking about something beyond that? Recognizing I'm getting into this debate very late, and I don't pretend to understand Oregon security law, and I need to know whether we're talking about the whole thing as we write these rules, or whether we're sticking it into a place where there's been a vacancy before, and that the definitions that were otherwise in existence before for the rest of it still apply. That's sort of what I'm asking.
Well, I like just comment this. My wife is a clinical psychologist also, and she tells me what the law is all the time, so I don't know why you can't.
Well, but just a note as well, Representative, it's kind of obvious that you're not up to speed because you're not using the term of art I've heard from Mr. Stoll. Never heard the word fraudulator before. I just figured that was a term of art in securities law.
Right.
That's a world of art.
It's the DSM-5.
So right. We call some cases as wacko cases. That's another legal term. No, I think I got off track. I can't remember what your question was.
I'm trying to understand whether the statute that we're working with here
yes.
applies to just a piece of the securities law or whether it applies in some way to the whole thing.
No. The only thing that is being modified here is the one that we're talking about, Mr. Esser was talking about it, about the aider and abettor language, is in the loss causation language is a new section. Is a new section that was added by 609. It does not change the previous, as Mr. Arellano indicated, does not change the pre 609 liability law.
And if I could follow up, and 609 deals with this fraud on the market issue.
That's correct.
Okay, an additional follow-up then. If I understand what fraud on the market means, we're not talking about an initial, we're probably not talking about an initial offering.
Right.
We're probably talking about some ongoing conduct sometime later where the participants would be a different group of people, wouldn't they?
Well, they
not
could
necessarily
be
the accountant and the lawyer who assisted in the making of the initial offering.
This, I'm going to give you a little bit of an it could be both. You could have a situation where you have a series of offerings. In other words, you have a first offering, and then we represented the plaintiffs in the Melridge case, which was a well-known case in Oregon, and there were a whole series of offerings. This is a flower bulb case. Anyway, there was a whole series of offerings. And so you had people that bought in subsequent offerings or bought in the open market that heard about something in an offering. So they could have liability. There could be liability based upon what was an offering, even though the person didn't. You know, WorldCom could have a bond offering and put out a false financial statement in connection with that bond offering. Even though you didn't buy the bonds, you might have seen the offering material and said, well, that looks like a well-run company, and they've got lots of assets, whatever, and so you buy the stock in the market. So it could be both.
I got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think that did clear up some issues for me. Hope for you as well, Representative. At least the point that I'm willing to move it forward, and if there's issues that the Senate might want to take up on this, maybe they can add to that. But I think it's at least been adequately explained that you know, this is a compromise position that has support from both sides of the issue.
Well, and there's one more thing, if I could, Mr. Chair, that interests me, and that is that it doesn't affect the existing liabilities. We're only talking about establishing a new tort, in effect, or a new cause of action, in effect, in 609. And I'm a lot less concerned when we're dealing with a new cause of action than I would be if we were talking about dealing with these new words in connection with an old cause of action that was already well defined.
Okay.
And that's, for me, that makes it a little different.
Okay. No one further then to testify on this. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3666. Open up a work session on House Bill 3666.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
I would move House Bill 3666 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 3666 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and Chair will carry the bill to the floor. And 3666, then, will move the floor with the due pass recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 3666 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2912. John Chandler. I challenge you to use the word scienter in your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler here on behalf of House Bill 2912, but first I'd like to express my appreciation for the chance to pick up some needed continuing legal education credits. I haven't heard the word scienter, Mr. Chairman, since the law school, I don't believe, and I remember it being a legal term.
Yeah.
Couldn't tell you what it had to do with anything, but that was fascinating. Maybe this is just as boring, land use, maybe this is boring to other folks. Securities law is, but it seems unlikely. House Bill 2912 was before the Environmental Natural Resource Committee a while ago, and we came out with the engrossed version. Since that time, we had a little work group that got together, met. You'll see other folks sign up to testify. I'm excited about this bill. I think we've improved it with the -9 amendments. You also have the -10s in front of you. What we're trying to do here is several things on a big picture level. The Oregon land use system, and those of you who have been listening to the committee testimony in various places in this building in previous sessions know, it's a very convoluted, complicated, and oftentimes controversial process. What 2912 is attempting to do is to set up a task force to look at our land use system. We're not presupposing outcomes. We're not trying to dictate that when we're done with this, it's going to be any particular flavor or even that any changes would necessarily be made in the system. From our standpoint, on behalf of the development industry, we believe that the system isn't working to do what we thought it was going to do in the first place. We don't believe it's working for developers. We don't believe it's working for citizens. We don't believe it's working for local government. We don't believe it's working for the state. We think it can be changed, not done away with, but improved. We support the land use system. We have since its inception in 1973. But the reality is, this idea kind of came up during the interim, frankly, but it also comes with many years of land use battles and going to the legislature, going to the courts. And I believe we've lost sight of the fact that when we started this in 1973, when Moses come down from Mount Sinai with Senate Bill 100 under his arm, we had a vision of the future. And the world that we're in 2003, if we were able to go back and set up an alternative universe, so to speak, and go back to 1973 and look to where we thought we were going to be in 2003 compared to where we are, in fact, in 2003, they'd be different. We don't have the same industries we thought we were going to get. We don't have the same growth patterns, the same growth rates, the same economy, the same implications, federal law, all the things that have happened in the last 30 years. And again, this isn't to say that the system is wrong or bad or flawed, but that it hasn't been looked at seriously. They didn't reduce it for 20 years, and that was on a different set of specific issues. When we brought the bill forward, it was pretty focused. It was tightly drawn to look at my clients' issues, development issues, economic development issues. After we passed it out of committee with a broader set of folks participating in the engrossed version, the governor's office, Thousand Friends, and others suggested that maybe we ought to be broader than that. Rather than just looking at urban issues, which is what our intent was initially, let's look at rural issues. Let's look at the range of the land use system. And what you see in the -9 amendments is just that. We want this task force to look at rural issues, urban issues, the urban-rural boundary, the interface between urban and rural, and I think very importantly, the relationship between state and local government. And over the years, we've lost track of that as well. In my mind, it's very different whether it's a state system locally administered or a local system of state oversight. Either one's fine. We've got to be clear about which this one is. I'm excited about this bill, and I appreciate you taking the time today late in the session, late in the day, to hear the testimony. You'll notice in looking at the -9s that the bill is silent as to the makeup of this committee. And we did that on purpose. Again, the bill that came out of committee in the first place, the Ingalls version had call-outs. You should have a builder, should have an environmental person, you should have a city person, that kind of person. And we realized after further discussion, particularly as the scope of the bill broadened, that that led to interest group pile-on. And this task force, this effort, is only going to be successful if it's focused. And task forces with 97 people on them hardly ever are all that focused. So it's silent. And we're basically saying with this bill to the Speaker, the Governor, the President, put good people on this. Put good people, not necessarily land use people. And one thing I wanted to say on the record, I don't know that I would be asked to serve in this process on this commission. If I were to be, I would refuse to do so. People like myself who are advocates, who are participants in the land use battles, I don't believe need to be on this. I think that'd be a mistake. I think what we need to do is get folks who are smart, who are engaged, who believe in Oregon, who care about Oregon, may or may not know much about the land use system. We've got land use experts all over the place, but who care and are thoughtful and don't bring a bias, don't bring an agenda to this. As I said in my written testimony, the land use system is integral, has become integral to the concept of Oregon. It's like the bottle bill. It's like not pumping our own gas. It's just one of those things that we're proud of here. And it's too important to let drift. It's too important to be examined lightly. And it's too important to be given back to the usual suspects to fiddle with. One thing I want to say also for the record, and I know there's maybe people I'd say this, a lot of the problems with our system were caused by folks like me coming to legislature over the years and tweaking here and adjusting there and fiddling there. Other problems come from other folks going to the courts and getting decisions. And as a result, I think the system is adrift and we need to go back to talking with ourselves as a state. What do we want out of our land use system? What do we want it to do? What do we want our communities to look like? What do we want our neighborhoods to look like? What industries do we want to look at? How does the transportation system function? All the pieces that go into a successful and functional land use plan. That's what we hope comes out of this. The last thing I want to say, and if I understand the system, the process correctly, this bill hopefully will move from this committee back down to Ways and Means. There will be a fiscal impact on this bill. I've seen several versions floating around. I don't know which one will be operative. It's going to cost money to do this. And this is not a good session to bring forward even swell ideas that cost money, and I understand that. I believe this was very important because of all the collisions we've had over the years and because of the implications on economic development and urban development that our land use system has. I will say again for the record, though, that if a sufficient amount of money isn't allocated through the Ways and Means process, and I will defer to other people smarter than me about what sufficient is, this is my bill. I mean, I don't have much control over it. I understand how things happen down the road. But to the extent I have any say in it, if there's not enough money, I will advocate the bill die. Again, I think it's a very important process and needs to be funded adequately at whatever that turns into, or it shouldn't be done. We have a challenge ahead of us. This is a part, in terms of getting our economy turned around, this is an important part of it. I would hope for your support and be glad to take any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't really have a question as such. I've been trying to review the dash nines and making certain I understood them. But I agree that it is time for us to do a mid-course review. It's time for us to get out our sextant and shoot the stars and figure out where we are. And I think that's what this bill with the dash nine amendments does. And now maybe I do have a question. Do you agree with that, or am I misunderstanding your point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that is exactly what the bill is intended to do. In fact, one of the things you'll notice between the you may have in your file the dash sevens, I think it was, and the dash nines, which are identical except for the name of the beast we're creating. The relating clause on this is relating to the Commission on Oregon Land Use Reform. That came out as an LC thing. It came out of LC. Some of the folks participating in this didn't like the term reform because they felt it implied that changes would be made. And while I didn't read it that way personally, I understand that. And I think the sextant is exactly right. The ship may be exactly where we think it is and where I think it ought to be. But without shooting that sextant and shooting the stars, we don't know. And we tried, like I said in my first testimony, we tried very hard not to presuppose outcomes. I mean, I know the answer to every one of the questions posed in here.
Okay.
Occasionally I've got 31 or 16 of you folks to agree with me. Sometimes I haven't. But I thought I personally believe it was important not to presuppose that the outcome of this should be what this commission and the outreach it does and the citizens of this state re-engaging with ourselves what they say it says. That's what our hope is.
Okay. Follow up, Representative?
Thank you. When does this commission report? Our task force. When does it report?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bernhard, there's two reports called for in the bill. It's a four-year process. The check-in in the 2005 legislature, final report in 2007.
I see.
The original bill had a two-year. When we broadened it, many of you know this already. There are thickets out there. The rural issues by themselves are going to occupy a significant amount of time, and I've already advised my colleagues on the work group that I'm busy that 6 months. I've been in those thickets before, and I didn't really want to go back. So we figured a four-year process with a two-year check-in and a review by this body, and frankly the funding of the next year with the second half of work, was the way to go.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, you're a brave soul. I know you know my part of the world, and I'm not sure exactly what you envision this task force doing or where they will meet, and I presume they'll go out into Oregon and hold public meetings and so forth. The problem is that it's very much like a person that comes to you with their reputation precedes them. And under the guise of land use, a lot of things have been done on the Southern Oregon coast that have been extremely harmful and have impacted families in a devastating way. And so it's a little bit hard for those families and those people to actually face that there are other reasons, not just land use. Land use planning or land use wasn't the only thing. But going into that environment, that's the hill that you have to climb. And it's real. It's not, it's very, very serious. And I think it will be very good, but I am relieved that you will look at rural Oregon because I think that we have had some excellent things that could have been done that have been prevented by people using the system in a way that it was never intended. And then we've had some things that needed to be done, and we want to be sure that you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. So I think that I'm excited for you, and at the same time, I hold some pretty deep reservations about how would be the best way to proceed to get the best answers from, I would say, certainly Coos County, Curry County, I would say from there all the way to the California border, that section of the coast.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bridger, if I may respond to that, in the Dash 10 amendments, the responsibility for picking this committee is spread. Those will be spread, and others will testify on the Dash 10s, between what they say is the governor, the speaker, and the president all do it. Nobody in the governor's office asked me for political advice, but this has potential to be explosive. We are opening a box here. I commend the other folks on the work group that helped put the bill in front of us here, because all of us have something to lose. I do, 1,000 Friends does, the other the combatants in this game and occasional collaborators do. Because you're right, this is going to be a very hot issue in rural areas. It's going to be a hot issue in the cities. Oh. But it needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that, and when we actually brought this concept forward in the 2001 session, and you all didn't see it because Governor Kitzhaber wasn't interested in doing it then for a variety of reasons, and that's fine. But the comment I made to the governor's staff that he didn't buy, but I still believe I was right, was that we can either have this conversation collectively, thoughtfully, and in an organized process, or we're going to have it in every county commission hearing, every city council meeting, every planning commission meeting, every permit application in the state, because the issues are out there, both good and bad, both yes, do more, do less. And I think it's important to do it systematically and take on the hill.
Okay, Paul.
I agree with you, and I think your timing is good. I can tell you that in my part of the world, there is an effort at this time to do completely away with the LCDC. I mean, these are things that have moved very far along in being able to... it's almost been because of a lack of conversation that you get these kind of movements. And so when you bring people to the table and you have those discussions and you bring the right people to the table, I think that will, John, be a key, that you bring the right people that don't come with preconceived ideas of the bottom line and what's going to happen. If everybody has to lose some, that's okay, but you've got to have people at the table willing to do that and take the loss.
And I would hope each of you would think of yourself as a possible participant in this process. Misery loving company and all.
Thanks for the suggestion. Representative Miles Anderson.
Thank you. You know, we have LCDC.
I've heard that.
And I mean, I would think their mission should incorporate these ideas. Why hasn't LCDC been able to accomplish reform, or is their mission entirely does not include this?
That's an excellent question. In some ways, it's a bit of a perfect storm, to use an overused cliche. What Representative Verger was talking about the feelings on the South Coast, there's always been this background level of dislike or out and out, antipathy towards the land use planning system, but as the economy soured, it got worse. And it was a lot of folks blame land use planning for Oregon's economic doldrums, which is, I wish it were true, it would make my job easier. It ain't so. LCDC's task has been to manage the program. One could argue whether they've done it well or not, but that's been their job. They really haven't been tasked, and for the last two gubernatorial administrations, they not only weren't asked to, but they weren't even encouraged to think bigger thoughts. That simply wasn't part of the workload, for one thing. It's a volunteer commission, limited time. The reason that we didn't suggest that the LCDC do this, and why we're suggesting another critter, is the same reason that I don't think I should be involved or any of the other players should be involved. It presupposes an outcome. If you're an LCDC commissioner, your job as that commissioner is to support, uphold, work through the land use system. A, and that's hard to do, and then to be dispassionate and say, but here's the problems with it. And secondly, all of us who play in this particular sandbox, and I was making fun of the previous bunch of witnesses, but I can borrow a committee room with the best of them on land use mumbo-jumbo. We get forest intrigued. You dive so deep into the details, because it's a detailed process, that you lose sight of it. And the LCDC commissioners who pay attention to their job, by necessity, have become part of get that syndrome going. So we thought it was important to get outside views, not necessarily familiar with land use, to look at it.
Thank you.
Like yourself, for example.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I just wanted to add one thing to what you said. I mean, the political processes in Oregon have, around this issue, have become very acute in the last, 5 or 6 or 7 years. And I think another huge value that you alluded to but didn't actually say is that getting another look in a very public way with hopefully thoughtful people who aren't established in a position on the issue may help us to understand where we want Oregon to go and be in the future and head off simple-minded reactions that can cause us a lot of trouble.
Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more. A lot of what we do in any system, it's not just land use, becomes formulaic.
Yeah.
We do it because we do it, not necessarily because it has an outcome we want or a desired purpose behind it. It's an interesting inter.
Well, then you get beyond the simple-mindedness of those who may have issues with land use. Ms. Chandler, the original bill suggested different members of this commission, now task force, representing different aspects of industry and local governments, et cetera, that are, should be part of this. What's your take on, I guess, going to a different route where it's just the, either the governor appointing basically whoever he wants or the dash 10s that has some unanimity among the presiding officers and the governor to appoint whom they choose, as opposed to designating specific individuals?
Mr. Chairman, I support what's in the dash 9s of, and I'm fine with the dash 10s for that matter as far as who appoints them. And the reason is this, when the bill was narrower in scope, the bill that came out of committee didn't have rural, it was urban and urban growth boundary and economic development and that sort of thing. And then it made more sense to have specific called out a metro person, a city person, and so on. Even then, I suspect we probably got a little fancier than we needed to. Essentially, what happened was two things. One, we broadened out the scope of the bill. And I think, again, that was a very gutsy thing on the part of the governor and others to suggest. And secondly, when the thought was, rather than try to get smart and say, okay, we need one from column A and two from column B and left-handed these and those and bald-headed those others, we ought to have smart, good people, regardless of their background. And that's not to say you shouldn't have city people, county people with the various interests called out in there. I mean, I'm going to argue like mad that there ought to be somebody there from the real estate development industry just because. But in terms of the legislation and either tying the governor's hands or the speaker's and president's hands, we felt it was much more important. And in a way, it was a trust, you know, a trust me thing, but it's also trying to elevate this to the level where I personally believe it needs to be. This could blow up. If the governor, and one shouldn't probably say this on the record, but I will know, if the governor's dumb enough to try to stack this thing, it will blow up. I don't believe he is. Or if the president, speaker, and the governor collectively dumb enough to try to do that. If we try to presuppose outcomes by lining up the interest groups, that's what got us in this mess.
Mm-hmm.
It's folks like me and others. I'm good at it. I like it. I can make a good living at it. But it's not necessarily been good for the state.
I see your partner agreeing with you in the background.
It's not necessarily been good for the state.
You're not seeing the nods behind you.
Well, and if the rest of the folks that testify don't cop to their role, I'm going to come back up here and point out what they did do and when. But my point, Mr. Chairman, is it needs to be those smart, good, 10 people who can sucker in the servant on this thing. It can't be the warriors, it can't be the combatants, it can't be the interest groups, because we've all played too long, too hard for our positions and our postures, and we're going to defend them. I have to. That's my job. I shouldn't play here. Bob Stacey has to. That's his job. Other folks have to. That's their job. This needs to be away from that. Hence, long answer, short question. Hence, no particular call-outs. I think it'll work.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Very quick question, Mr. Chandler. Well, as a follow-up to that, have you had discussions with the governor's office about your vision of what that should look like? I mean, you haven't obviously said, Mr. Governor, you wouldn't be dumb enough to, but have you had discussions that in the event this were to survive and be put into place, how it would be built?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I haven't had occasion.
Before you answer that, there's a representative of the governor's office here who can also respond what the governor's office believes on the issues. But you can feel free to.
The question of what I've not had a chance to talk to the governor himself about this. I did use that exact line with a couple members of his staff. I think it would be dumb.
Okay.
I'm willing to assume the governor isn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate
your testimony. Dave Hennicutt, can you come forward and talk about your proposed amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Hennicutt, Oregonians in Action. I've got the hidden dash 11 amendments, which reinstate Measure 7 into this bill. So ask the committee to
vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Sorry, not in work session.
The dash 10 amendments are ours, and the purpose behind the dash 10 amendments, and we, by the way, are supportive of the bill, but the purpose of the dash 10 amendments are just to help ensure that we have a bipartisan process in picking the folks that will sit on this committee. And my point early on with this bill was that if you don't pick the right people onto the committee, then the process is shot before it ever gets started, because everybody just walks away from the table and says, look, the committee is stacked, so obviously the results that they obtain will be biased as well. So the only purpose of the dash chins is to try and ensure that we have a bipartisan appointment process, that we get the right people on the team. Ross Day from our office did a little research. We pulled ORS 541-409, which is the independent multidisciplinary science team, which is also a committee opposed. I guess this one is composed of seven scientists. If you look at that particular statute, those folks are appointed by the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House, jointly appointed. The decision to appoint a member of that team shall be a unanimous decision by the appointing authorities. And from what I understand, that system works pretty well for the IMST. And so there's some precedent already in statute for what we're proposing with the dash 10s. So that's all our interests are with the dash 10s. I looked at the language in the dash 9s and the language with the dash 10s. It looks like there may be a need to make some amendments to the language in the dash 10s so that it conforms with the dash 9s, if the committee is so interested.
All right, questions? Representative Marhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed this language, 10 members who are knowledgeable about Oregon's land use system and who are familiar with Oregon's economic and employment base. The previous witness, I think, seemed to suggest at least that you want 10 bright people who don't necessarily have a position already on things. Do you think that his desires and the desires expressed in dash 10s for knowledgeable about Oregon's land use system and familiar with economic and employment base can both be met?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, I think the answer to that is yes. The problem with not having somebody who at least has some background with the land use planning system, and I agree with Mr. Chandler that the people sitting in this room probably shouldn't be on this work task. We can all finish each other's sentences. But the problem with having somebody who has absolutely no knowledge of the land use planning system is they'll spend the first 2 years just getting familiarizing themselves with the system, which may not lead them with enough time to actually come up with solutions or to have the discussion to try and come up with solutions if they decide that there are problems that need to be fixed. And so I think there are 10 people out there in this state that have some familiarity with the land use planning system that aren't completely biased one way or the other. And obviously, it would be our hope that they would find those people.
At least 10, we hope.
Yeah, well, land use planning in the state is somewhat of a religion one way or the other, and so. Hopefully we'll be able to find 10 that haven't been converted to one side or the other.
And just to clarify too, Mr. Endicott, you're basically you're fine with the dash 9s, the substantive portion of the dash 9s be except for the makeup of the, or determining the makeup of the task force.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And if the dash 10s need to be amended so that they fit within the dash 9s, we'd certainly be willing to come to one of the members, get a note, and see if we can get Ledge Council to help us with that.
Okay. Further questions, Mr. Endicott? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for testimony. And now there's a few folks that I guess are just going to be commenting on the amendments, but I would ask Mr. Bantoff, towards the end, we'll just kind of have you kind of do the recap, what you've heard based on the testimony, where you think the governor might be on this, and the various amendments. Stephen Cofori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cofori. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We comprise about 800 folks who are involved in professionals, land use planning. Part of those people work for governments. Part of those people work for private sectors representing developers. So we have a broad spectrum of people in our association. I was personally involved in the work group that developed this bill. Our organization is very strongly in support of it. We like the A9s. We could live with the dash 10s. I've had experience with the interdisciplinary, independent, multidisciplinary science team, and I found that that worked, I think, in a more contentious relationship between the governor and the presiding officers than we have now. So if it worked in that situation, I see no reason why it wouldn't work in this situation. I agree with Mr. Honeycutt that if you do go along with the dash 10s, the language in on line 3 and 4 need to be changed to change the name of the task force from the commission. I would suggest that, I don't know how in this body whether you agree with conceptual amendments or not, but if you do, that would seem to be something, seeing that we're in towards the end of the session, that this committee might want to do rather than go back to legislative council, if that's within, Mr. Chair, your protocols. I just want to say a couple quick things. One is that there are many new people in the state of Oregon to the land use planning process, both people who are young and people who have moved into the state. Those of us who have been around, I was here in 1973 and helped pass the original bill that I was talking with Representative Gallegos the other day, and she was, I think, 12 years old when it passed. A lot of people really do not understand what it is that we have, and as you said, it's become a religion. People talk in favor or opposing without understanding what it is they're talking about, unfortunately, too many times. We think, and we have pushed for a role of this new task force to be heavily outreached in the area of education as well as in the area of receiving opinions. We think that both of those functions are important for this task force, to let people know what the land use planning system is, as well as find out what they think about it. We have already started our own evaluation. We have a project that has been completed, and we'll be happy to present this to the committee if you're interested, that the American Planning Association has done on the first 30 years. We are very interested in this, and also our national organization is interested in this. We think often that we in Oregon, that this is kind of an insular thing, but what we have done here with that land use planning system is being watched all around the United States. We're the only ones who really have a system like this. And our national organization is willing to put in money, and we think that there is other grant money available from other organizations to ensure that this program gets funded so that it can do what it Mr. Chandler has expressed to you already. So we are supportive of this and hope that you will be as well.
Okay. Questions?
No? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Carl Levy, Levy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We support this bill. We'd like to thank Mr. Chandler and the OBIA for bringing it forward. Although we would have preferred that the members be listed out as they are in the engrossed version of the bill, in particular, we would like to see somebody representing the real estate industry on this commission. We would feel more comfortable that way. Because then it would be clearly delineated exactly who would be represented. Leaving it open-ended, we think, holds the potential that it could be more easily stacked one way or the other. We don't think that would do anybody a service. With that said, we hope that the membership is diverse, not only in who is represented on this commission, but also in the geographic locations and what parts of the state they all come from. We would hope that it would not consist of 10 members from the Portland area or even from the Willamette Valley. We would hope that geographic membership is as diverse as the state of Oregon is itself. With that said, I will close my remarks and be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, I don't have a question, but I'd like to go back to what Mr. Chandler said. I think if we're going to bring a whole group of special interest people to the table, you're just lost with the people that you're going to try to work with. Would you disagree with that?
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but we would like to see a little more focus in who, in what groups are involved. Land use is a very technical issue, and where I do differ from Mr. Chandler is I would think that people that get appointed this need to have some working knowledge of the system that we have here. It is a unique system. Other states do not have it. It's something that, as Mr. Honeycutt said, it would take 2 years for people that have no experience to just get brought up to speed as to what they were dealing with. And with that said, I do agree with Mr. Chandler that nobody in this room ought to be on that commission. It ought to bring in people that represent the various industries involved, but not necessarily the advocates, the ones that come here before you every day to argue their cases, pros and cons. People that are out there in the real world that are dealing with these issues on the ground, that are dealing with the land use system in their businesses, in what they do, in their ability, in their struggles to make a living. Those are the people that we would like to see appointed to this.
Good answer.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And let's see. How about Art Schlack, Lynn Ludwig?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from the League of Oregon Cities. The League would very much like to support House Bill 2912 and very much in support of the majority of the Dash 9 amendments here. We would like to speak to the issue of the task force makeup. We did hear earlier testimony talk about the land use planning system as we know it today as either being a state system with local implementation or perhaps a local system with state oversight. But there are two variables there that are absolutely the same that I don't think we're going to see change significantly. Those are two players, state and local, state oversight, local implementation. We've heard a lot about concerns with interest group pylons. Frankly, I don't see the role the state plays in the land use planning system as an interest group. I also don't see the role that the local government as the implementers of the planning system are as interest groups either. So I would ask if you are looking at the Dash 9s, which there are delineated a member of LCDC, that you would also consider putting some type of a city representative and a county representative on there as well. I think if you look at the Dash 9 amendments, which have been broadened out, there are four major roles and recommendations that this task force is going to make recommendations on. Every single one of those deals with state and local interests, and even more so, every single one of those has a very significant role for local government. So I would encourage you to think about that and perhaps add that to the A9 bill amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Schlock with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I guess at this point I'm in the enviable position of saying I echo and ditto everything that Linda Ludwig has said for the League of Oregon Cities. Cities and counties are the partners in the system and the implementers of the statewide land use planning system. So I think it's important that a representatives of cities and counties be involved in this task force. You might say, well, I can't think that they wouldn't. And you might be right at this point, but the only way to assure that they are is to identify them. And 2912 was amended to include representatives of counties and representative cities in the engrossed version that you have before you. And again, we see that as a preference. The state is recommended, as Linda has indicated, because a member of the Land Conservation and Development Commission is identified. And so if they can be identified and the state has their role and that's assured, then a role for an elected official from counties and cities should also be assured. And we would ask you to consider that. Other than that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties supports House Bill 2912 and the other elements of the Dash 9 amendments.
All right. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Did you have in mind a county commissioner?
Excuse me? Pardon me, Representative Berger.
Did you have in mind a county commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, no, I do not. I believe that there are 118 elected county commissioners and judges in the state of Oregon, and that the governor, searching that pool of talented people, would find one that would be appropriate to serve on this.
I'm sorry you misunderstood my question. I didn't mean a particular county commissioner. I just meant, did you mean an elected person, meaning a county commissioner?
Yes, Commissioner or Representative Berger, a county commissioner or a county judge.
And if that county, follow up, Mr. Chair, if that county commissioner came from Eastern Oregon and the coast would feel like that they weren't represented, what would you say to that?
Representative Berger, I would hope that the person who represents the counties would look at the counties on the basis of the statewide implication. Many times we have an elected county judge or commissioner who represents the association and or represents a statewide issue, and I would see that person having that perspective.
Linda, and who would you presume would be representing cities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I would concur to some degree with what Mr. Schlack said, and I think the real question that you're getting at, being an elected city official as a representative, I think the real question you're getting at, would it be better to have a local government official or a non-local government official? The local government official might only be representing the jurisdiction, the region, the area that they've been familiar with. And given the importance of the role as implementers in the land use planning process, I would say clearly we would be better off to have ensured local government representation in the task force than not to have that.
Mr. Chair, I guess, and I mean this in all due respect, looking at this bill looks to me like a fresh approach. Once I start hearing, please put this person on and please put that person on, it's the same old, same old. It's the same song, 10th verse. And I would love to see something different, but that's just my opinion.
All right. Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for testifying. And Bob Stacey.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Stacey, Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here today because I couldn't afford to persuade my lobbyist to stay after July 30th. I apologize.
I'm just
as upset as you are. Yes, I know. There's nothing much for me to do other than associate myself with John Chandler's testimony, and I'm pleased to do that. I don't get as many opportunities to do that as I would like. I know we agree often. But John brought this bill forward. It was in a different form. He accepted advice and guidance from the governor's office and other hangers-on, And I think the proposal before you in the Dash 9 amendments will do a great deal toward allowing Oregonians to engage in the kind of conversation they did about the future of their state the first time around in 1974 after the adoption of Senate Bill 100 in the 73 session, which led to 10,000 Oregonians participating in the goal adoption process. Can we do that again? Can we engage that percentage of Oregonians or a greater one in a dialogue about their future? That's the ambition of this legislation. Shame on us if we're afraid of the answers we find out, whether we're 1,000 Friends of Oregon or the development industry or local government. I hope you'll give favorable consideration to it. There are only two particular points that Mr. Chandler made that I want to second. One is that I'm prepared to take his pledge. None of us special interests should be on this task force. I pledge not to serve if my name is offered. And second, I think John said this, I read it into his comments, if this bill is not adequately funded to engage Oregonians, to hear them and not allow the microphone to be captured by those of us who do have points of view and do insist on being heard, but to find out what Oregonians in general and at large believe, and to gather information effectively about the performance of our statewide planning program, then we'll be kidding ourselves if we simply spend 4 years with an occasional microphone being set up in hearing rooms around the state. So I also don't know what the magic number is. There is a fiscal analysis and an estimate of the cost of doing this work that's been prepared. I think unless something like that number is allocated, this is not a wise undertaking. It won't be sufficient simply for us all to yell at one another in front of a body of people, no matter how smart they are. There need to be resources to give them the ability to carry out this work effectively. I subscribe to the premise that the appointing authority, and I support the Dash 9 Amendment's recommendation that the governor have that responsibility, pick the best possible Oregonians to do this work, not those of us who have made up our minds about a lot of the questions involved in the land use planning program. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stacey, I believe that I may have heard from earlier testimony that there could possibly be the consortium of all of you, your organizations, who do have concurrence on this matter, some sort of resourcing, funding, fund, or inputting of funds to help fund this particular task force. Is that a possibility? Has there been discussion along that line, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I know the Governor's Office, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the American Planning Association, Mr. Chandler's clients have all discussed in general the premise that there may be private sector or foundation resources available. And they may get to them before I do, but I'm in that business as well, and I can't be terribly optimistic about the capacity of the philanthropic world in the current economic climate to aid state government. But I don't play in the same league as the state of Oregon in terms of our capacity to approach and persuade foundations. A significant undertaking by the state of Oregon could well see matching contributions from foundations or others interested in this kind of work, and I hope it does.
And might want to point out Section 2 of the Dash 9 amendments, page 3, bottom of page 3, that discusses the ability for the governor to accept contributions to help fund this task force. Any further questions? And Mr. Stacey, I guess looking at the difference between the original version of 2912 and where we are now, you've had quite a change of heart. And I was on the Environment Land Use Committee when we first discussed this, and
I was chastised by my lobbyist, Mr. Chair, for sending that email.
Well, it was actually a very good letter, I thought, in some respects. One, because if you don't mind me reading some of your words back to you.
Please.
The last thing Oregon needs is an 18-month rehash of the same arguments by the same people about farmland versus sprawl, state versus local decision-making, and land use review versus local discretion. And then a little later saying, there will be spectacle, but there will be no new information. And I know it was in part because of the way I think that you looked at this, the whole presumption of that original bill about needing reform in land use versus, you know, maybe what was said earlier here is that maybe we don't change the land use planning process. You know, what do you see different now with this kind of task force versus what we saw originally?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three fundamentals, I think. One is an inclination not to presume that only those who've been involved in the process to date should be on the task force, but rather an expectation that good Oregonians who are smart and open-minded will be appointed. Second, that sufficient resources will be sought to do analysis that supports the work of the task force and obtain public input broadly from Oregonians and give Oregonians things to work with in that process. And third, enough time to do the job right. This measure proposes a 4-year period rather than essentially the 18 months we would have starting in January of 2004 until the 2005 session were upon us. This gives us the time to do an effective and thorough job, and those are the significant differences.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Dan Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nan Evans. I'm the Acting Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I find myself in a truly remarkable position of being able to wholeheartedly agree with John Chandler and wholeheartedly agree with Bob Stacey. Both the Commission and the Department do support this bill, and we support the Dash 9 amendments. And we were very intimately involved in the work group. It was a good process. The Commission was involved in the work group, and let me remind you that the Commission is composed of volunteers. Some of them are very knowledgeable in land use. Some are not. Some are supporters of land use system. Some are critics. But the Commission as a whole supports this, and the Department does as well. I think maybe just let me say three brief things, because I think you've heard the gist of all the arguments already, and I'm very sensitive and appreciative of Representative Verger's comment that this is a big and risk-prone, and the people on that task force are going to take a lot of arrows. But it's a conversation we have to have. Not because it's the 30th anniversary of Senate Bill 100, but because we haven't had this conversation recently. And it's time. There are way too many issues. We all know it. The Commission and the Department envisions such a task force of thoughtful, informed Oregonians who are committed to really the long-term welfare of the state of Oregon and its citizens, and set that as the criteria for who should be on the task force. We think that the issues identified in the Dash 9s are the right ones. We participated at great length in a conversation about what is the scope, and really pushed and supported the governor in thinking the scope of this ought to look at issues within the urban growth boundaries, issues at the interface between the urban growth boundaries and the rural areas, and look at the issues of the roles of state and local governments. I mean, that sort of distills kind of where the basic sets of issues are that people have with the land use system. And I guess the last thing I would say is that we believe it's worth doing, and we believe it's worth doing well. And well means having the funding to support the process. It's envisioned as a 4-year process. It will need staff. It will need resources. It will need thoughtful big thinkers on the task force. And it also needs very considerable public involvement. It needs public opinion research, and it needs public education. And that is it's an investment worth making if we're going to do this. And I would probably underscore the statements made earlier that if this is not the time and we don't have the resources to make that investment, then we shouldn't do it, just for the reasons that it is so big and it's so important that it's worth doing well.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Is 3.5 years enough time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is a good question. I think it's a pragmatic choice. I think we all knew that 2 years wasn't enough, and 6 years seemed interminable.
Okay.
So,
all right. Good answer. Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And batting cleanup, David Bantoff. Little baseball lingo there.
Chair, this is the ninth person to testify. That's not cleanup.
So noted.
I mean, tonight,
that's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to represent the governor here and provide some comments on 2912. And you've heard a lot of testimony, and we strongly support the Dash 9s and the reasoning behind that, that John Chandler and...
David, I need you to put your name on the record.
Well, excuse me. My name's Dave Vantoff. I'm the governor's natural resource policy advisor. So I think you've heard a lot of the rationale for how we got from the original bill to what is proposed in the Dash 9s. And the governor strongly supports what's in there and the concepts and the goals of the Dash 9s. I think, as other folks have mentioned, that from the governor's perspective, funding is absolutely key to whether or not this initiative can succeed, and we strongly support the bill with adequate funding. We have strong concerns without adequate funding, and the bill is in but what everybody thinks can reach adequate funding. But I would assert that if this truly is going to be a 4-year look at our entire land use system in a comprehensive way, looking forward 30 years, looking back over the past 30 years since Senate Bill 100. 500,000, 600,000, 700,000, whatever the fiscal would be on that for a biennium, is money well spent if it's done well, and we're going to get some answers and some common ground arrived at the end of the process. So it seems like a lot of money, especially in this tight fiscal times, but I think it would be extremely well spent. Again, I won't comment in detail on the Dash 9s, but I do want to touch on the proposals in the Dash 10s. And the two issues about whether to have a specific listing of folks that would be on the task force, and then also whether to have it become a unanimous decision-making process with the Speaker and the Senate President. The governor agrees with the previous comments in terms of why we try to get away from the list-making and the attempts to create a task force that's going to be representative of the entire state and coming with some different interests and perspectives, frankly, than what typically would come into a land use planning task force or group. And the governor is keenly aware, as John Chandler indicated, that this is a risky venture and that he is going to have to be very careful if he was given the authority to appoint the members of the task force to make sure that this is going to have the credibility that it absolutely will have to have to be successful. And that's, in some ways, that's taking even greater risk than advocating for a shared, unanimous decision-making process. But the governor strongly would prefer to have the ability to appoint the eight folks that are set out in the Dash 9s. We think that gives an opportunity to kind of try and put together a team, essentially, of people that have the right combinations to move this forward, which is a challenging and complicated task. And when you get into a unanimous decision-making process, that may be able to end up in the same place, but it's I think a more challenging one to not have that end up in a process where you're getting kind of the bargaining for interest group positions and that kind of thing that we're trying to avoid with the moving away from that direction. And we also, I would add, are confident that the task force could be assembled more quickly if the governor was able to make the appointments without going through the negotiating process of the unanimous decision-making. And in light of where the session is at now, I think it would be beneficial if we can try and get the task force up and running as soon as we can into this this biennium. And I'd be glad to answer any questions if anyone has any.
Okay. Questions? Ms. Vanoff, you heard the concerns expressed by cities and counties. How do you respond to their desire for local interests, I guess?
We absolutely agree that cities and counties are integral players in this this endeavor, and would definitely work with the cities and counties to make sure that their interests were adequately represented on the task force. I think the as an example of a recent task force that the governor put together was the Industrial Lands Task Force. There's representatives on that from city and county, and as there absolutely has to be as part of looking into this process. So I understand their concerns, and we would certainly work with them to address those.
Okay. And I think one of the other concerns just on this in general is making sure that we have at least geographic diversity represented on this task force. What kind of commitments can the governor give on that?
Again, absolutely, it has to be a diverse geographic representation, I think, to have the credibility to be able to really move this forward in a meaningful way. So we would be committed to finding, and again, I think looking at the Industrial Lands Task Force, you'll find out that it did have quite the geographic diversity. It had a diversity of people in terms of governmental backgrounds and business backgrounds. And yet, we really believe that it would be important for this, as has been said before, for this task force to not be a collection of interest groups, but truly a cross-section of Oregonians from across the board in terms of business, land use, folks that have interest in land use, governmental folks, people that bring in some perspectives that may not oftentimes be thought of in terms of land use. Obviously, economic development has become a big issue this session, as it should, and that would be an important component of what kind of skills people bring to the task force.
Okay. And I heard in your earlier testimony that one of the concerns about the Dash 10s is that then the governor may be forced to bargain away to interest groups. And I mean, the only way that would happen is if it's with the assumption that that's what the presiding officers would be doing.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that's what would happen. I'm just, there's less certainty as to how the process would evolve, how quickly it could evolve, and whether any, including the governor, any of the three would be starting to try and negotiate individuals for other individuals, as opposed to trying to just thinking in terms of a team. That may work out. It could work out wonderfully too. I don't have any experience with putting that together. So, yeah.
And also in your earlier testimony, you're looking for at least the. I think the success of this task force will be determined by what kind of not only what their findings are, but then what ultimately gets implemented. Through law, and I guess I don't see that just having one member from the Senate and one member from the House appointed to this task force as being able to achieve that objective as well as if we had the presiding officer's commitment and involvement up front on this. And it would be a different task force if it's the governor's task force versus something that's got buy-in by both presiding officers. Comment on that?
Well, I think it'll be essential that there is buy-in from both presiding officers, whether or not they appoint or have a role in the appointment of the other eight members. I think the bill and the concept behind it, I believe, has strong support throughout the legislature and the leadership of both governor's office and the Senate and the House. And I'm hopeful that that would be, that kind of support would follow whether or not the appointment process was under the, as set on the dash 10s or under the dash 9s.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger.
Yes, I have a question. Have you thought of a process by which there would be input by people all over the state, whether it's state legislators or business or people in economic development, that would submit names that you might look through? There's a political reality in this, and that is that there are certain people in any section of the state that have a lot of credibility with people there. They also have been impacted mm-hmm. by the land use, and that gives some balance to the task force. And I think it's very difficult for the governor or even all three to sit kind of someplace in an office and figure out who is going to be best in these different areas. And maybe you wouldn't choose any of them. But I think there maybe should be a process prior to that that you might consider in being able to come up with the right people.
Mr. Chair, I agree wholeheartedly. I think it would be a very useful endeavor for the governor to, and we haven't thought about specifically how this would occur, but to solicit recommendations and input from across the state and from various sectors and including the legislature, if that was the way if the dash nines were the way that it was being put together. And I think that's a very good point.
Further questions?
Well,
Representative Barnard.
Follow up on that. It would still work if the dash 10s were in place, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The same process could be used.
It could.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Boris.
Thank you. In the event, thank you, Mr. Van Toff. In the event the dash 10s were to be adopted and there was no prescribed membership, 10 appointees, what would preclude the possibility of a representative from the Land Conservation and Development Commission, a representative from cities, a representative from counties, partnering but not being a part of the assigned members to this work group?
I don't think anything would preclude that. I think you're saying if there weren't members from
LCBC. And at the request of the cities and counties.
Yeah, so if there's not representation, I think the dash nines are, which the dash tens would be incorporating, would be looking for LCDC to play a supporting role, and that may be appropriate for other groups as well, whether they're not on the committee.
Follow up.
I guess to perhaps make it a little bit more clear, my concern would be that with the dash nines, we have a representative from LCDC, and that's government. We have a representative from cities, that's government. We have a representative from counties, that's government. So that would take three of the eight appointments that would be available, and if we were to have then geographic representation of the state, if we divided it squarely in four, maybe that would work. But if they were outside the composition of the unit that's going to be undertaking this task, but working alongside, would that still not give them some sort of input, although not official?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's a good question. I'm not really able to. I can't think in terms of how that would work structurally. It may be something that would work well. I'm not familiar with enough of these prior task force where that was the model in which it was set up, or if there has been one. But that presumably could be a way to expand kind of the groups involved. I think with 10, and as I understand the dash 9, there's spelled out a representative from LCDC, but not from any of the other groups, so that would leave 9 positions open. Potentially for filling, and the 10 that we came up with too was I wouldn't say arbitrary, but it was an attempt to keep the task force at a manageable level where we thought maybe there'd be enough interaction and ability to function as a team again And, you know, I don't think it, I don't, at this, I guess John and some of the others, but I don't know if anyone's wed to 10 as the number that it has to be. It just, it's trying to find the right balance in terms of size and how to put together an effective team that'll work together well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Let me try to focus a little bit on the seriousness of this kind of situation where you've been through years now of impacting people's lives, and irregardless of how you and I feel about what really truly happened, perception is absolutely everything. And I would really be very concerned in my district if you had maybe just not the full task force, but two or three people mm-hmm. would come down to have a hearing, and one would be from the Land Conservation and Development Department. That would be a serious mistake. And so I just would like to have you really think through this task force a little bit more.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, thank you. And just a comment or two about that issue, if I may. I do note that on page 2 of the dash 9 under 7, sub 7, it indicates that a majority of the members of the Task Force on Land Use Planning constitutes a quorum for the transaction of business. I'm assuming transaction of business also means things like taking testimony and holding hearings and things of that sort. That might deal with some of that issue. Otherwise, I have to say I agree completely with Representative Berger about the importance of this kind of issue, that perception is everything. Getting a commission out here that's considered to be a blue ribbon commission full of smart people who are not wedded to a particular set of solutions but are open-minded and willing to look at whatever people bring in as a way of starting to build a new educational background for Oregonians and perhaps a new consensus on where we want to go. That's the thing that excites me about the possibilities of this commission that Mr. Chandler started at the beginning of this hearing. And I started out thinking, well, gee, we probably don't want to go with the dash 10s in terms of appointment, but if the President, the Speaker, and the Governor all approach this in the same manner that we're talking about it here, they'll be able to find 10 people who meet those qualifications and who will have credibility simply because they've been appointed by people with in some sense different interests in the process, and I could see that as being as perhaps being an asset rather than a detriment. Yeah, it's possible that they could, the three of them could get to loggerheads and not get a commission appointed, or get one that was a trade-off, in which case, of course, we would end up not paying any attention to it, wouldn't we? So I absolutely agree. I guess that I'm saying too long, but the point I want to make is that I agree with Representative Berger that if we do this, perception is all, and making sure that we get people who are going to be perceived as open and bright and capable and will come up with a report that's useful, and getting them to the meetings is going to be very important.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. Were you a part of the group that came up with the Dash 9s? I was just wondering what the thinking process was for changing to including a member from LCDC and leaving it pretty much open as far as the appointees. Why was a member of LCDC chosen to be a part of this task force?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I do not recall specifically why we made that decision. We could probably call up Bob Rindy, who I think was part of it, and may have a specific recollection. My guess is that there was a sense that what I do believe was the intent was that there'd be a commission member from LCDC as opposed to a staff person.
John Chandler said he named
Well, sorry, everybody can kind of sneak in. Bob, do you recall why LCDC was included as a specific named member?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I will have to confess that I don't remember any detailed discussion of why that was. I would think if Mr. Chandler has that in recollection, he should be here. I think it's not necessarily the case that this call out a member of the LCDC. I'd certainly want to hear from the consensus. This was a work group, and there was a broad range of interest, and we had a large number of discussions on this. And so I don't think any one of us, you're seeing a reluctance on my part to just try and speak for the group on this. So.
Okay. Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chairman, John Chandler, again, for the record, transfer of DeVos Anderson's question. That was, I think, what I pushed for the hardest, and that's why I was willing to come up and explain it. But I should have said this in answer to your earlier question, Representative. I think it's important to have somebody from the LCDC on this so it doesn't look like it's a coup. Yeah, I said earlier in response to your question why the LCDC itself shouldn't be running this program. Having said that, someone from that commission, who is the Land Use Commission after all, ought to be involved in the rewrite. And I think that's really important. And regardless of whether the nines or tens or how they're smushed together, I think it's still important to have somebody from the LCDC on there, if only out of respect for that body and out of respect for those folks who are serving there and the knowledge they bring to it. That's why I think it's important to call that out as a specific. That was the only call out that I thought was critical enough to leave in the bill after we pitched all the interest groups over the sign.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further for Mr. Vantoff? All right. Thank you, sir. Well, before we move into work session appreciate some comments from the members. I'm inclined to combine the dash A9s and A10s, and I see that there's some importance to having more legislative buy-in to this process, to this Blue Ribbon panel, than basically letting the governor have a task force that then at the end of it, he's kind of plops it on our desk and says, here's what we've decided to do. When we're basically in the legislature supposed to be having these, making these ultimate decisions on the legislation that would be proposed. Other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Yes. I'm not totally opposed to Aiken, although the dash 10s, but I can just see some problems, especially with the partisanship that has been shown in certain areas. I would hate to have this task force go down the tube just because we can't get the right people on, and the people that do end up on it, because there's consensus, maybe aren't the really the right people. So I would tend to hope that we could at least have the speaker and the president and the governor talk about the appointees, but not make it an absolute mandatory statement that they have to agree unanimously. I just feel that has some problems.
Anybody else? Representative Berger?
I have some concerns about the makeup. You're going to have a senator and a House, one, a representative and a member of LCDC. I don't know. I just wish that they had taken a more fresh approach and just simply selected people that were knowledgeable and, number one, were very, very good listeners. I think that the political people are going to get the report back. We're going to hear it. We're going to be able to read it. I don't know that we need to be on the task force. I don't know. The dash 10s going into the dash 9s is fine with me. I have no problem with that. I have concerns about how it's going to make up and not being ending up whole group, same old, a whole group of special interest people who are going to go out and have pretty much already preconceived ideas of how things ought to work, instead of listening to Oregonians that are out there and business people and using this. I notice here I have dated on April the 11th that this is part of the House Economic Recovery Plan. And that's the focus here, and I just hate to see us lose that focus.
Representative Beckwith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Honeycutt earlier mentioned that there is a precedent in current ORS for this sort of an approach in the Dash 10s. No one asked, and Dave did not say, but my presumption is that this is working. Is that nod this way indicates that?
No. Yeah, I think that was the testimony we seen.
Yeah.
We heard
the
earlier.
The testimony was that there is a precedent.
Yeah. And that it was working well.
It was working.
Yes. That's what I heard on the testimony.
Okay. Well, I think
the only problem is the legislators don't listen to them.
Yeah, well, that's yeah.
If you prove they're going to work, then you're going to work.
Yeah.
Follow Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So, if there is a precedent, and we're being told that there is for this sort of an approach to an appointment of a task force, that gives me a certain amount of comfort that this task force could also be successful. Obviously, we know that there's a great deal of emotionalism attached to land use planning. We know that a lot of people have been affected one way or another, adversely or in some other way. We know that a lot of people have kind of dug in their heel, so to speak, on the whole concept of land use planning. So truly the key would be the effectiveness of the group. And the makeup of the group, obviously, too, would be very significant. Again, I think I could go with the Dash 10s and the Dash 9s. I think a lot would have to be still determined by who is on the commission or the task force. But as a framework to get there, I think the Dash 10s and the Dash 9s are okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, Mr. Chair,
just
a concern, and it may not happen, but if one of the people locks up and says, no way am I going to approve that particular person, so I'm not going to, you know, budge. I just, having seen that already happening, you know, I can just see, no way, and it would slow up the process.
Representative Bernhardt, did you have something?
Yeah. Thank you. One of the things about a commission like this, the task force on land use planning. If this is a long shot, I think we have to say tonight. It's got to have money, which is in real short supply. It's going to have to develop a constituency in the Ways and Means Committee real fast in order to get through. If the commission gets stacked either on purpose or inadvertently, its recommendations will be ignored. They might be ignored anyway, even if it does a great job. I think the odds of actually pulling this off in a useful way are relatively small. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try it, just because the chances of actually being successful or small. The reality is that SB 100 was a very unlikely piece of legislation. The things that have come out as a result of SB 100 and the strong determination of Oregonians that we have a rational land use plan, those are unlikely events as they occurred and as they developed. I mean, we have all kinds of disagreements, even in this committee, about what the land use plan ought to be, but I don't think any of us disagree that we ought to have one. And that's something that's developed over the last 30 years. I guess I'm less concerned about whether we do the Dash 10s or not than I am with simply acknowledging that a whole bunch of things have to work right in order for this commission
to function and to be useful to us. At this point, I'd rather assume that they're all going to work right and pass the bill out than assume that they're not. And it is true that if one of these appointing agencies decides to dig in, it will not work. Well, okay, so it doesn't work. So we'll try something else. If in fact, if people are willing to operate on the standpoint of good faith and be forthcoming, and recognize the issue the reality that Representative Berger presented a while ago, plan could come up with this task force could come up with something that would be quite useful for us in a few years' time, and I'm willing to try it. Assuming we can get Ways and Means to put up some money, of course.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, with those comments, then let's go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2912 and open up a work session on House Bill 2912. And as chair, I will move to suspend the rules for the purpose of conceptually amending the Dash A9 amendments to House Bill 2912A. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. I also move to amend the Dash A9 amendments by deleting the last three words on line 6, which are, quote, appointed as follows, on page 1, and then deleting lines 7 through 12, on page 1, and then inserting the language from the Dash 10 amendments that basically begin on as the sixth word on line 4 starts, who are knowledgeable about Oregon's land use system and who are familiar with Oregon's economic and employment base, period. The President of the Senate, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the Governor shall agree unanimously on the appointment of members, period.
Okay, discussion?
Yes, discussion.
Okay. So that means, Mr. Chair, that the people on this committee could not be someone like me because I don't have I'm not knowledgeable about Oregon's land use system, just very rudimentary, and I'm not really familiar. I mean, who's going to define that then? I thought that who maybe really cares about Oregon's land use system, and but then that really, I think, limits who can be on this committee.
Representative Barnard, did you have a comment?
Yes, I had that same concern, and then I realized that we were going to figure out who's knowledgeable and who's familiar are the people who the Speaker, the President, and the Governor appoint. Whoever they appoint are the ones who are knowledgeable.
Whoever they are.
By definition.
That's right. That defines it.
So I don't think there's a problem with it.
I have to give him one on that. That's pretty good.
Well, and actually, I would concur. I mean, I guess I'm not looking at this as somebody who is. When you're saying who's knowledgeable about Oregon's land use system, my teenage daughters are knowledgeable about the Oregon's land use system just by, maybe just the fact that they live in Oregon and they've dealt with, having their parents involved in buying a house. I mean, that may be all it is. As well, it could be somebody who's just, has such, scientific or industrial or environmental expertise that is definitely one of the so-called resident experts on that kind of an issue, familiarity with economic and employment base. I mean, it's the degree of familiarity that is not defined here.
Let me sort of finish my comment. I guess then I think those are pious words rather than directional. because the fact is that the people on the commission are going to be those that those three great worthies agree upon. And so they're not directional words. They're simply pious hopes. The knowledge and familiar words.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a matter of degrees, I would think. You know, yeah. And it will be subject to interpretation, obviously.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, there would be people, for instance, in my district that would be very knowledgeable about land use. On the other hand, possibly someone who had been the third generation fisherman of a family on the South Coast who is very knowledgeable but has been impacted might be an excellent representation on the commission. So I think there's a lot to be put into the criteria of the members.
Okay. Further discussion on the proposed conceptual amendment. All right. Any objections?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused?
No. Aye.
And chair votes aye. And I guess the conceptual amendment then is ordered. And let's see. Of course, you can now kind of take over on moving the adoption.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the amended A-9 amendments to House Bill 2912.
Of course, moves adoption of the amended A-9 amendments. Any objection? See none, it's ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2912. To the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Oops.
Oh, sorry.
To the committee on, excuse me, may I restrike that? Strike that. I move House Bill 2912A as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 2912A as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
Let's do it.
Mr. Chair, it is interesting that this is one of the relatively few times that I can recall where proponents of the bill wanted to go to Ways and Means. Very interesting.
Well, yeah, anything further?
No, that's fine.
Okay. And I look at this, too, as maybe something beyond just a pipe dream. I think this is something we are hearing from the governor as a priority. I have heard certainly from our speaker that this is a priority. We're at that point. It is, and the idea that we're at 30 years of anniversary of Senate Bill 100, we have a lot to talk about, and the way that we can do this is with a blue ribbon panel such as this. And you know, just to share one thing with you briefly, because I know we're late into the evening, but sitting on the Environment and Land Use Committee this time around, you know, for me, probably personally, it was very frustrating just because of the number of times that we had to deal with individual, basically local land use planning issues because our statutes are not adequately covering the needs and desires of Oregon citizens, and then, you know, on top of that, seeing that we are not giving the right tools for local governments to be making these decisions. Right or wrong, it's not that we're trying to say that the land use laws need to be changed or need to be, you know, gutted to the point that we're not preserving Oregon's farmland and timberland, but also that and it doesn't mean that we're just trying to accommodate industrial growth either. But we are getting, you know, too many conflicting messages by the land use authorities based on their interpretations of our land use laws, and we have to address that. We can't do it without such a blue ribbon panel. And if the decision, you know, by the presiding officers and by the governor is to relegate this to nothing more than, you know, a partisan political maneuver, we're just lost. And it is just wrong to do it that way. And I just know in my heart of hearts that that is not the intention. Everybody wants to see our land use system fixed. And they want to see some movement and some progress in what we do. So there's a good opportunity here. Those who are looking to, turn this into just a partisan issue or just, one-sided issue, I think it's going to be in for a rude awakening. That's not the intention here. And I would venture to say that if, for some reason, this goes down to Ways and Means, and I will tell you, my direction from our speaker was that it's up to our committee to deal with the policy. It's only up to Ways and Means to find the money. If for some reason this comes out of Ways and Means with a different policy direction, then it would seem to me that there's no reason to fund it. I think that, if the governor, for instance, wants something, that's more in line with just the Dash 9s, that gives him that full authority to come up with something like this, and I'd say let the governor find it in another budget. He doesn't have to find it out of the revenue or the general fund, that we're trying to adopt with this Dash 9 amendment so that it's actually an expense that the legislature will commit to. So there are, I think, many good things that we can do with this, and I have every confidence our presiding officers and our governor will make sure that it happens in the right way. Call roll, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Cole.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. That Council 2912 work session is closed. Representative Barnhart.
One final comment, if I may, tonight. Your agenda stretched us in a couple of different ways tonight, and it's interesting to note that after all that stretching, we still managed to pass both bills unanimously.
Good point.
It's a very interesting committee meeting.
But, Mr. Chair, I don't think we'll be having it on the consent calendar, either one of them.
Right. All right. With that, we are adjourned.
You're going to carry it?
Oh,